Therefore, broadcast at this time.
From the Hall of the House of Representatives in the capital of the United States, CBS brings you the address by General of the Army Douglas MacArthur before a joint meeting of Congress. This is Charles Collingwood. Every seat on the floor of the House is filled with senators and representatives, and every seat in the gallery is likewise filled. Seated on the rostrum are the Vice President, Alvin Barkley of Kentucky, and the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn of Texas. Mrs. MacArthur arrived a short time ago, seated in the President's section of the gallery, still wearing the same purple dress with which she got off the plane last night. Young Arthur MacArthur arrived with others of the MacArthur party and is now seated on the floor. Both Mrs. MacArthur and General MacArthur's son received a standing ovation from the members of Congress and from the guests in the gallery. Everyone is waiting, the air electric with anticipation, for the announcement by doorkeeper William Fishbait Miller that General MacArthur has arrived. The doors of the House floor are opening now, and the next voice you hear will be the doorkeeper, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
The whole House and the gallery rises and applauds as General MacArthur, followed by a delegation from both houses of Congress, comes down the aisle toward the Speaker's rostrum. Everyone is clapping, Democrats and Republicans alike. There are a few cheers, some whistles, as the audience and the members of Congress on the floor enthusiastically applaud. The General is now shaking hands with Vice President Barkley, now with Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn. He turns and faces the microphone, but the audience is still busily applauding. He looks fit and soldierly, not tired by his long trip and many ceremonious receptions. He's looking around as the applause continues. Standing there on the rostrum below the Speaker and the Vice President of the United States, looking around, raising his hand in a familiar salute, he raises his left hand and is waving it at Mrs. MacArthur, standing in the Distinguished Visitors Gallery. The applause is dying down now. But it still goes on from the Republican side, as the Republicans continue to applaud, and it's picked up in some quarters of the Democratic side of the House. General MacArthur stands there patiently waiting, his hands on his manuscript. He looks around again, the applause stills.
Members of Congress, I deem it a high privilege, and I take great pleasure in presenting to you General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur.
Once more, the Republicans rise as a man and begin applauding. The Democrats rise again, as do the members of the gallery, and the applause for General MacArthur starts up once again. The General, who has not yet said a word, still stands erect, looking up at Mrs. MacArthur, who waves and nods to him, smiles encouragingly from her place in the Distinguished Visitors Gallery. General MacArthur.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, and distinguished members of the Congress, I stand on this rostrum with a sense of deep humility and great pride. Humility in the wake of those great American architects of our history who have stood here before me, pride in the reflection that this forum of legislative debate represents human liberty in the purest form yet devised. Here are centered the hopes and aspirations and faith of the entire human race. I do not stand here as advocate for any partisan cause, for the issues are fundamental and reach quite beyond the realm of partisan consideration. They must be resolved on the highest plane of national interest if our course is to prove sound and our future protected. I trust, therefore, that you will do me the justice of receiving that which I have to say as solely expressing the considered viewpoint of a fellow American. I address you with neither rancor nor bitterness. In the fading twilight of life, with but one purpose in mind, to serve my country. The issues are global and so interlocked that to consider the problems of one sector oblivious to those of another is but to court disaster for the whole. While Asia is commonly referred to as the gateway to Europe, it is no less true that Europe is the gateway to Asia, and the broad influence of the one cannot fail to have its impact upon the other. There are those who claim our strength is inadequate to protect on both fronts, that we cannot divide our effort. I can think of no greater expression of defeatism. If a potential enemy can divide his strength on two fronts, it is for us to counter his effort. The communist threat is a global one. Its successful advance in one sector threatens the destruction of every other sector. You cannot appease or otherwise surrender to communism in Asia without simultaneously undermining our efforts to halt its advance in Europe. Beyond pointing out these general truisms, I shall confine my discussion to the general areas of Asia. Before one may objectively assess the situation now existing there, he must comprehend something of Asia's past and the revolutionary changes which have marked her course up to the present. Long exploited by the so-called colonial powers, with little opportunity to achieve any degree of social justice, individual dignity, or a higher standard of life, such as guided our own noble administration of the Philippines, the peoples of Asia found their opportunity in the war just passed to throw off the shackles of colonialism and now see the dawn of new opportunity, a heretofore unfelt dignity, and the self-respect of political freedom. Mustering half of the Earth's population and 60% of its natural resources, these peoples are rapidly consolidating a new force, both moral and material, with which to raise the living standard and erect adaptations of the design of modern progress to their own distinct cultural environments. Whether one adheres to the concept of colonization or not, this is the direction of Asian progress, and it may not be stopped. It is a corollary to the shift of the world economic frontiers as the whole epicenter of world affairs rotates back toward the area whence it started. In this situation, it becomes vital that our own country orient its policies in consonance with this basic evolutionary condition rather than pursue a course blind to the reality that the colonial era is now past and the Asian peoples covet the right to shape their own free destiny. What they seek now is friendly guidance, understanding, and support, not imperious direction. The dignity of equality, and not the shame of subjugation. Their pre-war standard of life, pitifully low, is infinitely lower now in the devastation left in war's wake. World ideologies play little part in Asian thinking and are little understood. What the people strive for is the opportunity for a little more food in their stomachs, a little better clothing on their backs, a little firmer roof over their heads, and the realization of the normal nationalist urge for political freedom. These political social conditions have but an indirect bearing upon our own national security, but do form a backdrop to contemporary planning, which must be thoughtfully considered if we are to avoid the pitfalls of unrealism. Of more direct and immediate bearing upon our national security are the changes wrought in the strategic potential of the Pacific Ocean in the course of the past war. Prior thereto, the western strategic frontier of the United States lay on the littoral line of the Americas, with an exposed island salient extending out through Hawaii, Midway, and Guam to the Philippines. That salient proved not an outpost of strength, but an avenue of weakness along which the enemy could and did attack. The Pacific was a potential area of advance for any predatory force intent upon striking at the bordering land areas. All this was changed by our Pacific victory. Our strategic frontier then shifted to embrace the entire Pacific Ocean, which became a vast moat to protect us as long as we held it. Indeed, it acts as a protective shield for all of the Americas and all free lands of the Pacific Ocean area. We control it to the shores of Asia by a chain of islands extending in an arc from the Aleutians to the Marianas, held by us and our free allies. From this island chain, we can dominate with sea and air power every Asiatic port from Vladivostok to Singapore, with sea and air power every port, as I said, from Vladivostok to Singapore, and prevent any hostile movement into the Pacific. Any predatory attack from Asia must be an amphibious effort. No amphibious force can be successful without control of the sea lanes and the air over those lanes in its avenue of advance. With naval and air supremacy and modest ground elements to defend bases, any major attack from continental Asia toward us or our friends in the Pacific would be doomed to failure. Under such conditions, the Pacific no longer represents menacing avenues of approach for a prospective invader. It assumes instead the friendly aspect of a peaceful lake. Our line of defense is a natural one and can be maintained with a minimum of military effort and expense. It envisions no attack against anyone, nor does it provide the bastions essential for offensive operations, but properly maintained would be an invincible defense against aggression. The holding of this littoral defense line in the Western Pacific is entirely dependent upon holding all segments thereof. For any major breach of that line by an unfriendly power would render vulnerable to determined attack every other major segment. This is a military estimate as to which I have yet to find a military leader
who will take exception. For that reason, I have strongly recommended in the past, as a matter of military urgency, that under no circumstances must Formosa fall under communist control. Such an eventuality would at once threaten the freedom of the Philippines and the loss of Japan, and might well force our western frontier back to the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. To understand the changes which now appear upon the Chinese mainland, one must understand the changes in Chinese character and culture over the past 50 years. China up to 50 years ago was completely non-homogeneous, being compartmented into groups divided against each other. The war-making tendency was almost non-existent, as they still follow the tenets of the Confucian ideal of pacifist culture. At the turn of the century, under the regime of Chancellor Ling, efforts toward greater homogeneity produced the start of a nationalist urge. This was further and more successfully developed under the leadership of Chiang Kai-shek, but has been brought to its greatest fruition under the present regime, to the point that it has now taken on the character of a united nationalism of increasingly dominant aggressive tendencies. Through these past 50 years, the Chinese people have thus become militarized in their concepts and in their ideals. They now constitute excellent soldiers with competent staffs and commanders. This has produced a new and dominant power in Asia, which, for its own purposes, is allied with Soviet Russia, but which, in its own concepts and methods, has become aggressively imperialistic with a lust for expansion and increased power normal to this type of imperialism. There is little of the ideological concept either one way or another in the Chinese makeup. The standard of living is so low, and the capital accumulation has been so thoroughly dissipated by war, that the masses are desperate and avid to follow any leadership which seems to promise the alleviation of local stringencies. I have from the beginning believed that the Chinese communist support of the North Koreans was the dominant one. Their interests at present parallel to those of the Soviet. But I believe that the aggressiveness recently displayed, not only in Korea, but also in Indochina and Tibet, and pointing potentially toward the south, reflects predominantly the same lust for the expansion of power which has animated every would-be conqueror since the beginning of time. The Japanese people, since the war, have undergone the greatest reformation recorded in modern history. With a commendable will, eagerness to learn, and marked capacity to understand, they have from the ashes left in war's wake erected in Japan an edifice dedicated to the primacy of individual liberty and personal dignity. And in the ensuing process, there has been created a truly representative government committed to the advance of political morality, freedom of economic enterprise, and social justice. Politically, economically, and socially, Japan is now abreast of many free nations of the earth and will not again fail the universal trust. That it may be counted upon to wield a profoundly beneficial influence over the course of events in Asia is attested by the magnificent manner in which the Japanese people have met the recent challenge of war, unrest, and confusion surrounding them from the outside and checked communism within their own frontiers without the slightest slackening in their forward progress. I sent all four of our occupation divisions to the Korean battlefront without the slightest qualms as to the effect the resulting power vacuum upon Japan. The results fully justified my faith. I know of no nation more serene, orderly, and industrious, nor in which higher hopes can be entertained for future constructive service in the advance of the human race. At our former war, the Philippines, we can look forward in confidence that the existing unrest will be corrected and a strong and healthy nation will grow in the longer aftermath of war's terrible destructiveness. We must be patient and understanding and never fail them as in our hour of need. They did not fail us. A Christian nation, the Philippines stand as a mighty bulwark of Christianity in the Far East, and its capacity for high moral leadership in Asia is unlimited. On Formosa, the government of the Republic of China has had the opportunity to refute by action much of the malicious gossip which so undermined the strength of its leadership on the Chinese mainland. The Formosan people are receiving a just and enlightened administration with majority representation on the organs of government, and politically, economically, and socially, they appear to be advancing along sound and constructive lines. With this brief insight into the surrounding areas, I now turn to the Korean conflict. While I was not consulted prior to the President's decision to intervene in support of the Republic of Korea, that decision, from a military standpoint, proved a sound one. As we hurled back the invader and decimated his forces, our victory was complete and our objectives within reach when Red China intervened with numerically superior ground forces. This created a new war and an entirely new situation, a situation not contemplated when our forces were committed against the North Korean invaders, a situation which called for new decisions in the diplomatic sphere to permit the realistic adjustment of military strategy. Such decisions have not been forthcoming. While no man in his right mind would advocate sending our ground forces into continental China, and such was never given a thought, the new situation did urgently demand a drastic revision of strategic planning if our political aim was to defeat this new enemy as we had defeated the old. apart from the military need, as I saw it, to neutralize the sanctuary protection given the enemy north of the Yalu, I felt that military necessity in the conduct of the war made necessary, first, the intensification of our economic blockade against China. Two, the imposition of a naval blockade against the China coast. Three, removal of restrictions on air reconnaissance of China's coastal areas and up Manchuria. Four, removal of restrictions on the forces of the Republic of China on Formosa with logistical support to contribute to their effective operation against the common enemy. For entertaining these views, all professionally designed to support our forces committed to Korea and bring hostilities to an end with the least possible delay and at the saving of countless American and Allied lives, I have been severely criticized in lay circles, principally abroad, despite my understanding that from a military standpoint, the above views have been fully shared in past by practically every military leader concerned with the Korean campaign, including our own Joint Chiefs of Staff. Called for reinforcements, but was informed that reinforcements were not available. I made clear that if not permitted to destroy the enemy build-up bases north of the Yalu, if not permitted to utilize the friendly Chinese force of some 600,000 men on Formosa, if not permitted to blockade the China coast to prevent the Chinese Reds from getting succor from without, and if there were to be no hope of major reinforcements, the position of the command from the military standpoint forbade victory. We could hold in Korea by constant maneuver and at an approximate area where our supply line advantages were in balance with the supply line disadvantages of the enemy. But we could hope at best for only an indecisive campaign with its terrible and constant attrition upon our forces if the enemy utilized his full military potential. I have constantly called for the new political decisions essential to a solution. Efforts have been made to distort my position. It has been said, in effect, that I was a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing to me is more revolting. I have long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international disputes. Indeed, on the second day of September 1945, just following the surrender of the Japanese nation on the battleship Missouri, I formally cautioned as follows. Men, since the beginning of time, have sought peace. Various methods through the ages have been attempted to devise an international process to prevent or settle disputes between nations. From the very start, workable methods were found insofar as individual citizens were concerned. But the mechanics of an instrumentality of larger international scope have never been successful. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn fail, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blots out this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we will not devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon will be at our door. The problem basically is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescent and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advances in science, art, literature, and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. But once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. In war, there is no substitute for victory. There are some who, for varying reasons, would appease Red China. They are blind to history's clear lesson. For history teaches with unmistakable emphasis that appeasement but begets new and bloodier war. It points to no single instance where this end has justified that means, where appeasement has led to more than a sham peace. Like blackmail, it lays the basis for new and successively greater demands until, as in blackmail, violence becomes the only other alternative. Why, my soldiers asked of me, surrender military advantages to an enemy in the field? I could not answer. Some may say, to avoid spread of the conflict into an all-out war with China. Others, to avoid Soviet intervention. Neither explanation seems valid. For China is already engaging with the maximum power it can commit, and the Soviet will not necessarily mesh its actions with our moves. Like a cobra, any new enemy will more likely strike whenever it feels that the relativity in military or other potential is in its favor on a worldwide basis. The tragedy of Korea is further heightened by the fact that as military action is confined to its territorial limits, it condemns that nation, which it is our purpose to save, to suffer the devastating impact of full naval and air bombardment, while the enemy's sanctuaries are fully protected from such attack and devastation. Of the nations of the world, Korea alone, up to now, is the sole one which has risked its all against communism. The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description. They have chosen to risk death rather than slavery. Their last words to me were, "Don't scuttle the Pacific." I have just left your fighting sons in Korea. They have met all tests there, and I can report to you without reservation They are splendid in every way. It was my constant effort to preserve them and end this savage conflict honorably and with the least loss of time and a minimum sacrifice of life. Its growing bloodshed has caused me the deepest anguish and anxiety. Those gallant men will remain often in my thoughts and in my prayers always. Closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the right to see that duty. Goodbye.
General applause, takes hands with Speaker Sam Rayburn, Vice President Barkley, exchanges a few words with him, turns once again and faces the audience, looking around, shaking hands now with some of the members of the Senate and the House who are beginning to crowd around him. From the gallery, his wife looks down proudly. Up beside her, there's a handkerchief for the eyes. She's waving now to her husband, and he waves back. General MacArthur waves to his wife in the gallery. He comes down to the floor and makes his way out amid many a handshake and a smiling greeting to the members of the House. He walks out, nodding, smiling, shaking hands again. Now, walking out down the center aisle toward the door, General MacArthur has left the hall of the House of Representatives, but still the applause continues. Now it dies down, and more than one group is being formed on the House floor before they adjourn, as one member after another speaks to each other about the address that they have just heard by General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. The applause which punctuated the speech by General MacArthur came in large measure from the Republican side. The Democrats, except for a few sprinklings of applause, were quiet but attentive. The whole floor of the House was still as General MacArthur, beginning slowly but gathering more and more intensity in his voice, spoke to the hall. You could have heard a pin drop in the House of Representatives. The gallery was quiet, too. Everyone's attention was on the figure who stood there before them, not in the dress uniform, not in the tunic which the other general officers who were in attendance wore, but in the short battle jacket, which during the last war we used to call the Eisenhower jacket. It's the familiar garb which General MacArthur likes to wear, and when he addressed Congress, he appeared in that short battle jacket which he made so familiar during the Pacific War. You could almost tell who was who in Washington by those people who sat in the galleries who were able to get seats, and out in front of the Capitol, a considerable group of people were standing watching General MacArthur. It was a scene of almost unparalleled drama and intensity here in the House of Representatives, as General MacArthur, symbolizing as he did for many of those the great military tradition of the United States, stood up and made his farewell speech to the Congress and, as he said, to the people. CBS News brings you recorded highlights of the congressional reaction to General MacArthur's address to a joint meeting of both houses of Congress today. This is Charles Collingwood. The climax of General MacArthur's return to the United States occurred today when he entered the hall of the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. and addressed a joint meeting of Congress. The membership of both houses of Congress assembled to do General MacArthur honor and to hear his views on the foreign and military policy of the United States in the Far East. General MacArthur did not disappoint them. If there had been those who expected him to make a non-committal, pro forma address, avoiding the issues which had led to his dismissal, they were proved wrong. General MacArthur, after a non-controversial exposition of his views on the history and social structure of the East, swung into a hard-hitting and bitter defense of his position. He raised all the issues which others had raised and entered wholeheartedly into the swelling debate which his removal had occasioned. As General MacArthur spoke, the Congress split sharply along party lines. You could feel it as he spoke. You could hear it in the applause, which, except for the ovation at the beginning and at the end, sprang largely from the Republican side and carried only scatteringly to the Democratic side. No sooner had General MacArthur finished than impromptu debates sprang up all over the Capitol. CBS reporters hastened to bring important senators and representatives to our microphones to record for you some of the flavor of the reaction within Congress which General MacArthur's speech had engendered. We have assembled some of these reactions taken in the first few minutes after General MacArthur's address, so that you may catch some of the impact on Congress and some of the trends of the first stages of the great debate which has now begun. The Republican leader of the Senate, Kenneth Wherry of Nebraska, set the tone for the Republicans, who include most of the Republicans, who support General MacArthur.
General MacArthur made the most superb speech to the Congress that's been made since I've been in the United States Senate. And I think it has made a more profound impression upon the members of Congress than any speech that I have heard in the United States Senate. General MacArthur has made the issue in Korea indelibly clear. He has shown the president's inept policy of drift as our boys fight and die in Korea is intolerable. The American people are demanding action by the commander-in-chief of the armed forces to bring the war in Korea to a speedy and victorious end. The people salute General MacArthur.
That was Senator Kenneth Wherry of Nebraska giving a typical Republican view. The Democrats, however, who had sat silent during most of MacArthur's address, were not wordless after he had finished. They found in his speech some comfort for their own position. A typical Democratic first reaction was that of Representative John McCormick of Massachusetts, majority leader of the House of Representatives.
General MacArthur presented his views in a very masterly way. Most of us agree with about everything he said, but insofar as involvement in the general war in China is concerned, those parts of his address must be explored very carefully, because above all, at this particular time, it would be unwise, as I see it, for our troops in large numbers to get involved in China. It seems rather difficult to me to understand how Chiang Kai-shek's troops can go back and reconquer China when they fail to defend their own homeland in Asia and in China without American troops preceding them, and that means involvement. But that's the main question that the American people will have to consider and which will be discussed. The important, another very basic consideration that General MacArthur conveyed to the American people is the fact that the situation is global. There are many members of Congress who believe in giving up Europe to the communist. General MacArthur certainly vigorously repudiated and denounced that. As we view his entire speech, in the main and largely, it's a support of the policies of the present administration under the leadership of President Truman. It certainly must have made the faces and the feelings, the faces of the isolationist members of Congress red and disturbed their inward feelings, because his entire address can only be construed as a complete denunciation and repudiation of isolationism.
That was the majority leader of the House of Representatives, Representative McCormick of Massachusetts. Many Democrats, however, were more cautious, sensitive to MacArthur's hold on the public, paying tribute to his abilities, being noncommittal about the views and the policies he supported. Here is Representative Percy Priest of Tennessee, the Democratic whip in the House.
Well, I thought that General MacArthur gave a very eloquent and scholarly statement of his views on the military and the political situation in the Pacific. And I think we would all perhaps have to characterize his speech as one of the great dramatic orations of our day.
The Republicans were under no such compulsion to handle General MacArthur with kid gloves. They were on the warpath. Here is Representative Carl Hinshaw, Republican of California.
That was the most powerful speech that I have ever heard or read. The only thing I can see now is that the entire government should resign, effective on the date of the swearing-in of their successors, and a new election should be held forthwith.
Not all Democrats split sharply with MacArthur. Many of the Democrats were deeply disturbed by General MacArthur's charges, demanded full investigation. One of those was Representative Eddie Hebert of Louisiana, a Southern Democrat who has had his brushes with the administration.
He did not pull any punches, and to use the jargon of the street, he laid it right on the line. I think the one powerful thing in his entire speech was the mention of the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff subscribed to his philosophy of the conduct of the war and the manner in which it should be fought. That is the most important thing in the speech and demands an answer from somebody.
But congressional investigations don't happen by themselves. They involve different committees with different calls upon the investigation. Representative Hebert went on to talk about how the investigation should be conducted.
Of course, I can't speak for the Armed Services Committee. I can only speak as one member of it. But reflecting my own views in the matter, I think that the House, the Armed Services Committee, should participate equally with the Senate Committee on the entire discussion. And I certainly would recommend a joint meeting of the two committees in order that we have no overlapping and get the full picture. Because while the General MacArthur today had the soliloquy to himself, now the time comes for the questions to be asked, which will be most interesting. I think that today we've witnessed, as I told you before, and we're waiting for the General to come in, we've witnessed the greatest example of democracy at work in our lifetime. What do you think would have happened to General MacArthur if he'd been a Russian general? You couldn't have found the body. And here we have it being threshed out right in the open, the chief executive trying to justify himself and the military leader trying to justify himself in the eyes of the people. And again, I say, putting it right on the line. It's the most healthy thing that has ever happened, certainly in my lifetime. And if Stalin or the other communist leaders get any solace out of this present conflict of views, they'd better wake up.
But the present conflict of views in the United States disturbed Democrats and Republicans alike. Not all Republicans were unaware of the criticism of General MacArthur, which has been raised in administration circles. One of those is Representative Charles Halleck, Republican of Indiana, a leader in the Republican side of the House of Representatives.
Well, let me say this, that it certainly was a magnificent presentation of his viewpoint, and it ought to put to shame those who have said that MacArthur sought war or was a warmonger or desired anything other than the cessation of hostilities in the way that all American people would want them ended.
The Democrats in the Senate as well as in the House were concerned about the possibilities of widespread public recrimination and a great debate on our Far Eastern policy. One of those who spoke in this vein was Senator Herbert Lehman of New York.
The steps which General MacArthur has advocated would inevitably cause an all-out war on the mainland of China, a war in which we would be at a hopeless disadvantage. Any policy which would extend the present action in Korea would, I believe, lead to a world war and threaten the security of our country and of the entire free world. I deeply hope that the debate on the policy to be followed by this country will be brief and without partisan rancor, so that we may proceed with the least possible delay to cement the unity of our country and pursue the great business at hand.
But the Republicans knew that they had the advantage after General MacArthur's speech to the Houses of Congress, and they came to the Democrats full of attack, one of whom was Senator Everett Dirksen, Republican of Illinois, who defeated former Senate Majority Leader Scott Lucas in the last election.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just came away from the House chamber where I heard a magnificent, stirring, and shall I say devastating address. Our sturdy people wept on this occasion, and particularly as General MacArthur echoed that old note from a barrack room ballad, old soldiers never die, they fade away. But he'll not fade away because he interposed some essential footnotes to history that you'll hear more about. In all this business, of course, there had to be someone who did the job, shall I say, did the hatchet job, and we shall be looking for him. And I think the fight will just start here on Capitol Hill as we address ourselves to the things that the general said expressly and by implication.
One of those Republican senators who has supported General MacArthur throughout his campaign for a change in administration policies was Senator William F. Noland, Republican of California, who had this to say.
The speech of General Douglas MacArthur was a powerful one, which clearly outlined the dangers which face us on our Pacific flank from the menace of the international communism. If the government and the people of the United States ignore his warning, we do it at our peril, and we jeopardize the peace of the world and the security of this nation.
For another Democratic view, this time from a senator whom many Americans have seen on television when he was a member of the Kefauver Crime Investigating Committee, Senator Herbert R. O'Connor, Democrat of Maryland.
Our people today have had the experience of listening to one of the greatest presentations by one of the greatest Americans of all times. I feel that as a result of this experience today, that we ought to be even more confirmed in the realization that General MacArthur's matchless leadership and knowledge should not be lost to this country at the present time. Furthermore, I'm confidently of the belief that as a result of his magnificent effort, America will come to a position of greater unity and solidarity in our all-out defense against communist aggression.
Another Democratic view, that of Senator John J. Sparkman, Democrat of Alabama, who had sat in on the United Nations meetings.
General MacArthur made a wonderful speech to Congress today, a powerful speech. There was only one point in it that really gave me concern, and that was his statement that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had approved of his four-point program. I am eager, as I know many other members of Congress must be, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff to give us a clarification on that particular point. That was one other thing that I think we ought to keep in mind. General MacArthur's four-point plan, as he placed it before us, was based upon two assumptions. And if either one of these assumptions should prove to be incorrect, it might very well be fatal. For instance, he said, you may recall, that the plan would work, he felt certain, because the Chinese had already committed their full forces in Korea. And second, that the Russians would not intervene.
General MacArthur's speech before the two houses of Congress this afternoon was one of the great dramatic moments in the history of Congress. The days to come will unfold the rest of the story, which you have just heard begun in the words of the legislators, both Democratic and Republican, which we recorded this afternoon while the words of General Douglas MacArthur still rang in their ears. This is Charles Collingwood, and this is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Can I directly to those in high places who have accused him of advocating a policy which would lead us into a general war? In outlining the policies he advocates to bring the Korean War to a successful conclusion, he stated categorically that his recommendations were supported by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think this provided the greatest surprise in his speech, for if it's true, the Congress and the nation have been seriously misinformed. We have been told that our present policy is supported by both our State Department and the Pentagon. At this point, it becomes the solemn duty of Congress to find out just who is recommending our present policy.
We take you first to Los Angeles.
Out here on the Pacific Coast, the editorial reaction to General MacArthur's speech before the Congress follows the national pattern. Agreement with the principles stressed by the general and approval of his oratorical ability. At this hour, the editorial reaction seems to be pretty much on a level with the public reaction to the MacArthur address. In any event, the overall tone and temper of the newspaper viewpoint is set by the editorial which the Los Angeles Times will carry in its Friday morning edition. The Times says, in part, it was one of the best reasoned, most forceful, most cogent speeches ever delivered in the United States Capitol. Its keynote was a single phrase which the general attributed to our Korean allies. Don't scuttle the Pacific. The Times editorial continues, it was a solemn warning to the United States and to the non-communist world that it is just as dangerous to lose one part of the earth to the enemy as any other part. The editorial goes on, General MacArthur has had many occasions on which he seemed great. But history may record that when he appeared before Congress on April 19, 1951, it was his finest hour. Those are the highlights from the editorial appearing in the Friday morning edition of the Los Angeles Times. We take you next to Denver.
The Rocky Mountain News, a Scripps Howard newspaper, will say editorially tomorrow morning, General MacArthur's speech was a message of hope and courage, of faith and firm conviction. He had been called a warmonger, but he offered a way to secure the peace and save American lives, and he challenged the Joint Chiefs of Staff to deny the validity of that plan. Each new tabulation of American casualties will add strength to his demand for prompt decisions which will end this conflict honorably and with a minimum sacrifice of lives. So says the Rocky Mountain News. The Denver Post will say editorially tomorrow that General MacArthur is a great soldier and a great orator. The newspaper says the general ably reviewed his case for a stronger effort in the Korea War, but he added very little that was unknown before. The Post will say that General MacArthur gave Congress a great deal of ammunition for this specific phase of the great debate over foreign policy. He did not, however, says the newspaper, make clear a number of issues of utmost importance, or whether he wanted this action taken by the UN, or failing that, if the action should be taken by the United States alone. Neither did the general say at what stage he believed such action should be taken. These, of course, says the Post, are vital questions. They determine the degree of involvement that the United States would accept in a new war of this kind. The Denver Post agrees with nearly all of the principles laid down by the general, yet there are more important matters in the world than these. If it means the breakup of the United Nations, the Post would oppose bombing of Manchurian bases and blockade of the China coast. Above all, we believe the fighting members of the United Nations must remain united, says the editorial. The Post editorial will close on these words. Finally, let Congress, the people, and the administration decide what policy we will pursue in the United Nations, but let the decision be made on the ground of honest opinion and not from the expedience of party politics. That's all from Denver. Go ahead, Chicago.
Here in the Midwest, Lansing, Michigan State Journal calls the address an historic, convincing plea for realistic adjustment to the existing situation, which revealed his broad grasp of the military, political, and other basic changes in the Far East. That MacArthur is by no means fading away as one of the greatest Americans whose patriotism and broad knowledge will continue to serve his country. Cedar Rapids, Iowa's Gazette says MacArthur's inbred poise, quiet dignity, and magnificent restraint are qualities many of the confused little men serving as our leaders have never known and may not have recognized. That is for Congress to set aside partisanship and strip the issue bare of entangling personalities in order to set the best course for this country. Omaha, Nebraska's World Herald praises MacArthur's wisdom, sincerity, humility, astonishing eloquence, and deep conviction. Says the picture of the old soldier as he bade farewell to his people is one which will not soon be forgotten. That most Americans will thank God for Douglas MacArthur, a great and brave patriot who sacrificed his position to save his country from what he deemed a monstrous error. The Chicago Tribune here says if this was MacArthur's fade out, it was accomplished in a blinding flash of light. that no one who heard it will forget it, will fail to agree with its logic and compelling truth, that has ended America's fumbling course in Korea, dispelled confusion, that there's nothing any longer to argue, that the country has heard a great, sincere patriot making Roosevelt's glittering forensics sparkle like fool's gold to catch the votes of fools, that has reduced Truman's to the pitiful disclosures of the limits of a small mind. For, says the Tribune, MacArthur spoke not to win something, but to save the security and liberty of the United States and the lives of Americans wearing the same uniform as he, that MacArthur has put before Congress its duty to the American people and their sons in Korea. Abandon the program of Acheson, Truman, Britain, and the UN, who've overruled our greatest military man, whose speech the Tribune calls the greatest of all his memorable services. Bob Segrist in Chicago. Our program continues from Miami.
In regard to the general speech tomorrow, the general speech tomorrow morning's Miami Herald says in part, there was nothing particularly new in it other than the unequivocal declaration that his program concept for the present military situation and his plan for the long-range defense of the Pacific had the approval of the military leaders conversant with the Korean campaign, including our own Joint Chiefs of Staff. Despite its dramatic appeal, its stirring moments of oratory of high order, the sense remained that the general's appearance actually settled nothing. There was the feeling that when the tumult of the joint session died, the President, Secretary of State Acheson, and the Defend Europe First military leaders, General Omar Bradley and General Dwight Eisenhower, would still be in the saddle and would continue to make the decisions. The people wanted to know just what MacArthur would have us do. He did not back away from that. He called the argument that our strength is inadequate to protect both fronts, that we cannot divide our effort, sheer defeatism. What the general had to say about the events leading up to his removal as Supreme Commander in the Far East should be of immediate concern to the people more than his program for Pacific defense. It was those events that caused MacArthur's summary recall. They set up the unparalleled scene in our long history of a general standing before the Congress explaining why he had been impelled to openly oppose his commander-in-chief. If the members of Congress, particularly the Republicans, accept MacArthur's disclaimer of political argument and base their decisions on his speech solely upon the highest plane of national interest, Capitol Hill can demand of the administration that new decisions be forthcoming, that our foreign policy be clarified, that it have a constancy and a purpose which it now lacks, that it will move and act in the national interest that the free peoples of the world may understand and be assured thereby. That way may not be MacArthur's way, but it surely will not be the way of Secretary Acheson. The ways of Acheson eventually led General MacArthur to explain himself to Congress and the people, a confession to the world that our Department of State has not known, nor does not now know, what its foreign policy is or should be. And now to the Mutual Newsroom in New York.
The New York Times expresses the opinion that the speech revealed this major factor, that the disagreement between General MacArthur and the Truman administration is far less wide on fundamental points than the disagreement between the Truman administration and either the Hoover-wary Taft wing of the Republican Party or the remnants of Mr. Wallace's former following. By making this clear, comments the Times, General MacArthur has performed a service which should help to unify this country and the rest of the free world. The New York Herald Tribune does not think MacArthur differed greatly from the conclusions of nearly all other informed minds. In touching on several points in the address, the Herald Tribune says that MacArthur has now presented his case in such a way that it can be rationally debated. The paper sums up its case by grouping MacArthur with other sincere men of divergent views, perhaps, but men devoted to the ideals of freedom. General MacArthur, in leaving that deep impression behind his moving words, made perhaps his greatest contribution to this difficult hour in our history. In the nation's capital, the Washington Times Herald applauds General MacArthur's comment that, like the old